thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
Bye.
Here's John Williams.
This is John in the Skyline Studio, downtown Chicago. How are you today? We're here weekdays 1 to 3, Saturdays 10 to noon.
Lord have mercy.
Remember, on social media, I'm WGN King John. That's where you find me in all the usual suspected places. Don't miss the Mincing Rascals podcast. It drops today at 5 o'clock. The usual gang of suspects and some other folks joined us for the Mincing Rascals podcast today. And the gang spoke almost exclusively about Chicago-based topics. We usually go to Trump land. How can you not? But we pretty much avoided that topic today. I don't know if that'll increase or decrease sales, but I sure hope you enjoy and share with your friends the Mincing Rascals, judged by the Illinois Broadcasters Association to be the best podcast in the state of Illinois this year. You know, one of the things we talked about, and it's something I want to talk about briefly on the radio today, we've got a busy show planned, is what happened to those Wheaton College students that last December decided to hand out some leaflets at Millennium Park. Millennium Park is one of the best places in Chicago. It's one of the best places in the state. It really is one of the best parks in the United States. In an article in the Tribune, they described it as one of the most visited spaces in America or something like that. I believe in Chicago that's actually Navy Pier, but it sure is a jewel in our city. And the bean, that polished bean-shaped orb that was vandalized earlier this year, that's maybe the jewel of the jewel, isn't it? That's really a special place. It's fun to go there. If you haven't in a while, you should. To watch the people watch the bean, to watch the bean, to take pictures of it and take pictures of yourself reflected in it. And then they have that pond next to it, the little shallow rectangular pool with the two obelisks that are lit, that display faces that spew water out of their mouths. And the landscaping's grown in at Millennium Park, too. So that where first those were large trees they planted and bushes, now the stuff's really grown in. And it just feels like a great city park along Michigan Avenue. So there's these kids from Wheaton College, and I guess it's part of their ministry, part of their routine, where on Friday nights they have dinner, they pray, and then they head out into the cities and they evangelize. They hand out literature, talk to people about the redeeming power of God. And they were doing that in Millennium Park last December, and some guards came up to them and said, "Hey, you're not supposed to do that here. And you have to stop handing out your literature." And when they did that, one of the kids said, "All right, I won't hand out literature, but I'll just start to preach." So he started to evangelize to whomever was nearby. And they said, "You can't do that either." When the kids got back to school, they thought maybe their rights were violated. They got an attorney, and the students are now suing the city of Chicago. Now, I didn't know this, but in a story by Javante Anderson in the Tribune today, it says that one of the rules that the Department of Cultural Affairs and Special Events has, they run Millennium Park, is that this great park is divided into 11 areas. Did you know that? There's not lines that delineate them clearly, but they know where they are. And of those 11 spaces, only one are you allowed to speechify to people passing by. And that does not include the bean. The bean is one of the highest tourist attractions in the United States, it says. The rules ban conduct that objectively interferes with visitors' ability to enjoy the park's artistic displays, impairs pedestrian traffic, or disrupts the view of art. You cannot have conduct that objectively interferes with somebody else's ability to enjoy the art or the flow of people moving around. If you disrupt my view, then you can't do that either. I guess some of that's a tough call on what is what. But they're suing the city, and the city's fighting back. The Rascals were talking about this, and there were two views in the room, and I thought both of them were pretty well stated. Eric Zorn said that he understands free speech. Nobody enjoys it more than Eric Zorn does. But he says, boy, if you do this, if you let these good Christian kids from Wheaton just hand out their literature and speechify a little bit, you're going to open up a can of worms. You can have all kinds of crazy there because everybody will do it for the same principle. If it's good for them, then it's good for the Muslims and the Jews and the Hare Krishnas and the people that don't like America and the people that do like America. And it's going to become what he said was, you know, the old soapbox bug house square that we celebrate in Chicago, where people just stand up and get some time to yell to anybody what their beliefs and views are. Maybe that's cool, maybe that's not, but that's not what Millennium Park is today. But then the other side of the room said, you're trying to turn Millennium Park into the suburbs, where everything is neat and clean and clearly delineated and stratified. And one of the great things about cities like Chicago around the world is that there are kinds of different people. And you are going to encounter things that aren't super comfortable or within your norm. And that's okay. It's part of the show. What are you afraid of? I don't know. I mean, I see both points. I'm a middle child. But I really love Millennium Park. And I really love the area around the Bean. You can tell I get there a little bit. And I would hate to see us ruin the pleasant aesthetic and thing that that is. If that just became a place that you had to kind of get through rather than you could really enjoy, then we would have changed it. And to me, that's an argument for not letting people hand out their religious views there. I wonder what you thought about that. What have you encountered?
Like this group, if they do they want to hear Satanists preaching in that same area?
Right.
Because that's what they're kind of fighting for right now.
Right. I'll bet you that the people that were stopping them in the city of Chicago doesn't mind these nice half dozen kids from Wheaton College taking the train in to do that. But it's what will follow that mm-hmm. will worry them. And by the way, maybe you don't even like the nice kids from Wheaton College espousing their views. But if you don't like that, you sure as hell ain't going to like what else shows up, right? I mean, is that what you're saying, Jen?
Oh, exactly. Or, you know, politicians lobbying for votes and, you know, trying to express their views. And, you know, everybody wants to go there to go on vacation and try to get away from any of that type of thinking. So I agree that there is a time and a place in there. And there is an area. There's that Wrigley Hall or Wrigley area that they can, you know, partake in this type of.
Oh, you mean the place with the columns?
Yeah. So there is an area, like out of those 11 sections, there is one area that they're allowed to do this. It's just not by the Bean.
And you know what happens is, if they're doing that there, that'll be the area everybody avoids. I mean, they want to go where the people are, and the people go to the Bean. But I think that's incumbent upon them. They need to find a way to present their message that will attract people rather than invade the space where people are.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. I don't know. 312-981-7200. Text if you agree with me. I'm not even sure. You know, really, I am a middle child on this. I guess if I'm king, and sometimes I don't want to be, I'll farm this out, Jen. When I get to be king, I will put you in charge of Millennium Park.
Oh.
And I think I'm going to ask you to keep that kind of speech in a cordoned off area.
Okay. But what about, like, you know, food trucks? Can we just have pizza and churros everywhere? Is that
okay? I know. The city of Chicago needs more food trucks.
We do.
I was walking on Grace Street over by just a few blocks north of Wrigley Field the other day. And in this little tucked away park under a tree, and it was kind of dark now, was a guy with a pushcart hot dog stand. And nobody could see him. And he was just calling out from behind a tree, hot dogs, Italian beef. And I thought, oh, bless your heart. I'll bet you're hiding over there. You may be operating illegally, but we should have more guys selling wieners on the street. Or you walk up and down Michigan Avenue or State Street. I don't know. Pick the spot.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of great hand food in this city.
No, where you can just stop and grab something.
Grab a taco, grab a hot dog. You don't have that.
You know, one of the greatest perks of the Chicago Marathon is running through Pilsen and being able to buy a churro if you have some cash on you.
As you run the marathon?
Oh, yeah.
Now, that's... that's dangerous.
People think that I run to be healthy. I run to eat.
Yeah, the running is to make up for what you've done, huh?
Exactly.
You know, when they do movies and TV shows set in Chicago, right?
Uh-huh.
A lot of times the guy will stop out in front of the Tribune or Sun-Times building and grab a hot dog while he's talking about the case.
Doesn't exist.
They can't do that.
No.
There's nobody selling hot dogs on the streets of Chicago. You know, with a line of mustard and some relish and onions. A Chicago dog you cannot buy, as celebrated as that is, a Chicago dog on the streets of this city. Certainly not where the tourists are. Certainly not in the Gold Coast. Certainly not on the Mag Mile. We'll pause here. You're going to be able to buy plenty of pot there, but you will not be able to get a wiener. It's 119 on WGN. The number's 312-981-7200. Also, I really like what we're doing for the rest of the show as well. I'll just mention one guest coming up at 2:05. Where are you going to be at 2:05, 2:10? Michael Abels scored the music to the movie Get Out. The Jordan Peele movie, 4 Academy nominations. Peele won for Best Original Screenplay. And the score to that movie is really good. And you don't even pay attention to it. You just know it was creepy and eerie. But then if you think about it and listen for it, you go, oh, this is really good. The guy had never scored a movie before. And then he does Get Out. And Get Out, he got it. They're doing that movie at the Auditorium Theater Saturday night. They're going to show it on the big screen. This is what they do at Ravinia, right? You show the movie on the big screen and then an orchestra. This will be members of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra will play the score live to the movie at the Auditorium Theater. Oh, that's good. I know what you're thinking. Who's going to do the teacup? Jen, were you reading the text? What did one of the texters say? I don't have the text line in front of me.
Okay, so one of the texts says, let me find it again. I apologize. Hey, John, isn't this the same college that got rid of a teacher who wore a hijab in solidarity of Muslim women? No sympathy for their infringement of free speech.
This is John on line one. You're on WGN. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi. I don't know. Was the First Amendment changed to read freedom of speech will not be abridged unless the city of Chicago decides certain areas won't have it? Was the First Amendment changed?
It is not. I get your point. Thank you for the call. There are rules and regulations about even in a city what you can say and where you can say it. The question is, what is a public space, right? And isn't it reasonable that the city sort of allows traffic to flow and people to have their space respected? But that flies in the face of what you're saying. That's the rock and the hard place. There's no doubt about it. Mike, you're on the air. What can we do for you?
Hey, John, you know, you talked about the food trucks and Chicago starting to sell pot on Michigan Avenue. What, you think it'd be beneficial if they had more food trucks selling? Because everyone who's buying pot could have the munch.
Oh, that's good. Really, if you know what, we're crazy. If we're going to allow people to smoke pot or at least buy it on Michigan Avenue, then we sure as heck better have some snacks.
They're not going to be able to get food quick enough. Like, where's the nearest food truck?
You got to feed the need.
Thank you, Mike. Hang up your phone now.
Nobody wants to stand in a line at Chipotle. Come on.
A text poured in and it said, this is why New York is better. And that was said by line four. Hello, mystery person. You're on the air.
John, I just speak the truth. I try to be honest, and I know it's not popular. I just want us to be better, John Williams. That's all I'm doing over here.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mark Carmen from WGN, formerly of WGN Radio.
Oh, my gosh. Carmen!
What the hell's the matter with you?
You know, John, when you walk around New York, you get to a corner, and there's this thing called a bodega, and you walk in, and they make you an egg and cheese or a turkey sandwich. And it's delicious, and it costs like $5-6. And then you get on the subway in New York, and it zings around, and it takes you everywhere, and you don't have to transfer to buses. And, you know, and then you can walk down the street, and, oh, there's a slice of pizza for 99 cents, and there's a hot dog cart, and there's a skewer. We just need to be better. That's all I'm saying.
Where do you hail from?
Hail from here, Jen.
Okay. Just making sure.
Well, it doesn't sound like it.
Well, you see, that's the thing. Like, we could just defend that we're the best, and I love Chicago, and I love Wrigley Field, and I love Guaranteed Rate, and I love the United Center, and I miss Chicago Stadium. But New York just does things better, and we should try to top them. We could be better, but for whatever reason. You ever ride the L around here? Try it in the loop. crawling, creaking, crawling, not moving, and maybe, and eventually you'll get there. I mean, come on, Chicago.
I take the L every day. I take the red line downtown and into the loop, and my record this year was 5 trains stopped in front of me, so crowded I couldn't get on. It was the 5th or 6th train that I finally was able to get on. That was a Cubs game. It was a Friday. But I think they need to pay attention to that. I think the fact that that's the way it is doesn't mean the way it should be. They've got to pay attention to that, and they don't. But if you wanted to just start to throw down New York versus Chicago, I don't know. I think I can win that one, Carm.
Well, you're gonna pay less for your rent. You're gonna have a larger place. What else you got
in Chicago? Well, listen. Here's where I'll meet you. That if you can buy a slice of pizza on the streets in New York for 99 cents and it's pretty good, then they're winning that category. Because I don't know where you can buy a slice of pizza on the street in Chicago. Certainly not, you know, this grand space that you think of when you think of downtown. When the blimp is flying over Chicago for a game, you look down, you cannot buy a slice of pizza or a hot dog anywhere within the sight of that. Now, you can get it, you know, you can get one at Millennium Park, but it's at the Grill, and it's expensive, and it's not what I'm talking about.
Right. And we could do this. How hard is this?
All right.
I don't understand.
All right, when I get to be king, I'm going to put you in. Jen is in charge of Millennium Park, but you're going to be in charge of hot dogs on the street, okay?
I'm in, John. I'm there for you as much as I can help. I want us to win. This is about victory.
I bet we can make a small fortune if we just started up at least one hot dog stand.
No kidding. I mean, I'll bet it's a licensing issue, but I'll bet if you just walk that up and down on a weekday afternoon in Chicago, you'd pay for that cart by the time you got, you know, down to the river. Hey, Carm, did you watch the Cubs game last night? I got to run here, but did you watch the Cubs last night?
I saw bits and pieces, John. Yes, disappointing.
I'm okay with us losing, but I counted 4 base running errors in that game last night. 4 basic. The double that what's his face got, our favorite doubles hitter,
Castellanos.
That was a base running error. He got away with it, and then Bryant.
Yep.
And Schwarber, I mean, come on. I know we want to win, and these games are critical, but we're going to run ourselves out of games if we just don't start playing good basic baseball.
I think there's something to them just trying to do too much, and they sort of have been doing that all season. I don't want to blame it on the fact they're trying to, like, save Joe Maddon's job, but Brian alluded to that the other day, and which makes me think there might be some truth to it, John, and that's just disappointing. But they should be better than that regardless. You're spot on.
When are you going to be on the radio again, Carm?
We're out of the end zone on Saturday, myself and Adam Hogue in advance of the Northwestern and Michigan State. So looking forward to that, John. Thanks for asking.
Taking my slot, so 10 o'clock in the morning. Are you guys on at 10 or are you on at 9?
I believe we're on at 10. 10. We'll be out there, though, at 9, you know, if you want to come on by and talk New York, Chicago. And you can buy a hot dog on the street out in Evanston. Mustard's Last Stand does a great job with that, although they should not be charging $5. Make that $2. It's a better move.
I'm hanging up on you now, Mark Harmon.
Okay, goodbye.
Goodbye. It's 1:30 into the WGN Radio Newsroom. We'll get you the stories that matter. And then, this will be fun. Brian Becker is going to join us, the chairman and CEO of Base Entertainment. You know, yesterday we were talking about how those holograms creep us out and they're doing a Whitney Houston hologram tour. The guy that does those will be on after the news. Phil, where's a fun, unique, affordable date night in the Northwest Burbs?
That one drove me nuts. First, I thought is Use Mandarin, which is in Schaumburg on Golf Road. One of the things they do is they hand pull their own noodles. And on weekends, where I'm assuming this first date is taking place, they will do hand pulling noodle demonstrations that you can see from the dining room.
Yeah.
And it's colorful and it's real nice inside.
Well, who doesn't want a hand pulled noodle on a first date? So that's nice to hear.
Right. Well, you got to watch these guys do it. It's pretty.
Phil Vitale's the restaurant critic at the Chicago Tribune joins us on Wednesdays. If you call or text in on Wednesday, he'll give you answers to questions like that. Where's a good place for date night? Where's a good steak and a cocktail for friends coming in from California? Feel free to join us on Wednesdays for that segment at 1:30. And if he doesn't have the answers then we answer them the week after that. So always be listening Wednesdays to us. at 1:30 with the Tribune's Phil Vitale, the restaurant critic there. Yesterday, we were also talking about this hologram tour. I'm a little out of the loop on hologram tours, to be honest with you. I didn't know there was a Buddy Holly Roy Orbison tour. I watched some video of that online. It's not just that they can do it. It's eerie how young and fresh and handsome and talented those people were, and they do seem to come to life on stage. But I understand the sort of queasy feeling some people have to see Whitney Houston performing around the country and around the world. The Whitney Houston hologram tour will kick off early next year. It'll open overseas to start. It's got a bunch of international dates, and then it comes to the United States, well, to North America anyway, tentatively planned for the fall of 2020. The trek is called An Evening with Whitney Houston, and it'll officially launch January 23rd of next year in Mexico before then heading overseas. It'll wrap up in Belarus. So Whitney's an international star. I'm sure there's an audience for her wherever it goes, but what about it? And how do they do that, for crying out loud? On a phone line is the chairman and CEO of Base Entertainment. Brian Becker joins us on WGN. Brian, welcome to WGN in Chicago. How are you?
I'm well, fine. I'm well, thank you. How are you?
Good. Will that show come to Chicago anytime?
Yes, it will, definitely. You know, we had such great success with Callas in concert, with the Lyric Opera, and the reviews were great, and Chicago's one of my favorite towns for a variety of reasons. So, yes, we'll definitely be there.
I'm going to try and keep this line going. You're cracking up a little bit, but if... That's just okay. If we have to, we'll hang up and call you right back, but let's see how it goes.
Okay.
How do you do it?
Okay.
Can you tell me about the technology?
Yeah, well, look, these are full-scale theatrical concert spectacles, which means that there is a director and a creator, in this case, Fatima Robinson, who has worked with the Black Eyed Peas and done Grammys and Oscars, who write, and we work very closely with the estate, Pat Houston. And so there's a script, there's choreography, there's a narrative, there's a song selection, there's a set, just like you'd see on Broadway. But what the issue that we have to really be able to deliver what we hope is a celebration of the legacy of this artist is a cogent 75-minute or 90-minute show. So we have to create it from scratch. And what that means is we find an actor or an actress, we rehearse, in this case, her for 8 to 12 weeks. We work with the master recordings of Whitney and, if necessary, digitally enhance them for 2020 ears. We have all the costumes and everything you'd see, like I said, on Broadway or in Chicago or anywhere else. And we put it all together and we film it. And then we'll use CGI technology. In fact, we're in the studio now with computer generated imaging. And then we'll put the whole thing together. But the holographic technology, which also, by the way, is fundamentally a cinematic technique, which means that up on stage we can have animation and all sorts of special effects. I mean, if we were doing Mary Poppins, we could have Mary Poppins as a living artist performing with, you know, the penguins at the same time. And so we have live actors on stage, we have live musicians on stage, live singers, dancers, we put it all together. And that's how we do it.
The singer is an actress, or is it Whitney Houston?
The singer is an actress performing as Whitney Houston. It is not old footage that we have changed or altered in a computer. It is an actress. This is a theatrical concert performance.
So is that person live on the stage, or are they hologrammed onto the stage?
They are filmed as a hologram, and it's the hologram that performs on stage.
Why not just put the actress on stage?
Well, what we think that we're presenting is a different way of celebrating these artists' legacy. So if we want to have a combination of the master recordings of the actual artist, in this case, Whitney, you know, performs perfectly in sync with a performer on stage. That's number one. And number two, if we want to take advantage of all of the special effects and animation and other creative elements that this allows us to do, and we cannot do that if we were having just a live person on stage. I mean, there are tribute acts and tribute bands out there that do these things, you know, with all these artists. And, you know, in this case, the estate and the record company and all the people that were important and close to Whitney that are protecting her legacy can actually control what this show looks like, as opposed to the others. And we think that that's why we have such a high level of quality and excitement and entertainment.
And it's not the actor singing, now that I think about this. Pardon me while I just kind of come to grips with what we're even talking about, because this is new to me. So the voice, the music, the singing is Whitney Houston. And do you superimpose her face onto the face of the actress?
No, we don't.
So she's lip syncing to Whitney Houston then.
Right. And the actress is up there. We will not superimpose Whitney's face. We will use computer generated imaging to improve the look of the artist who's performing as Whitney, but that artist is doing all the moves and is lip syncing, and the actual voice that you hear is Whitney. But the music you hear outside of the voice, the band, the backup singers, all that is live as well. I mean, it's a really fascinating thing when you think about it, because you have a music director that has to make sure that the hologram and the digital and the voice recording of Whitney, along with the band and the singers, are all playing together at the same time. And I'm just waiting for them to have a sneezing fit or something, and all of a sudden we're a beat off. But we haven't had that yet, so thankfully we're so far so good.
And I guess the fact that you film it, if you will, and then project it as a hologram ensures that the lip syncing will be done perfectly every time. We're not watching an actress on stage try to manage that. We're watching it done perfectly over and over again. The hologram appears on stage. So this hologram, this photo that I'm looking at, it's some of the promotional material, is a young Whitney Houston. She's got high heel sandals, blue jeans with the knees fashionably torn out, the jacket. Is that Whitney Houston, or is that the actress that looks like Whitney Houston?
That is the actress.
Oh, my God.
That we have now.
That looks like Whitney Houston.
And that's only about 85% complete, by the way.
And that must be a weird acting position for her. I mean, imagine that. So I guess you're looking for somebody who sort of fits the body part and the face, looks like her, and then can also, I guess, mimic convincingly Whitney Houston's stage actions. Is that right?
That's right. Now, you know, in addition, the actress in this case has to be talented and has to be able to dance and to move and have a presence on stage. And and then, of course, you know, we're creating a new theatrical piece here. So there are additional moves and additional things that Fatima and Pat, you know, put into the piece, plus all the special effects. So it's a really, like I said, it takes us, 12 months to do one of these.
You know, we talked about this yesterday. You weren't here, of course. We reached out to you yesterday. We had the conversation anyway, and I'm glad you were able to join us today. But the first reaction for some of us, myself included, was I'm uncomfortable with this. I don't like this. It seems to be resurrecting people against, if not their will, against their knowledge. The more you're talking about it, the more I'm grasping it as a different version of that. I'm still on the fence, but this is fascinating, Brian.
Right. Well, the first thing I would say is give it a chance and go see it, because technology is embraced by 95% of the artists that I've worked with over my career. Embrace technology as a new opportunity to extend and expand and innovate their art. But the second thing I would say to you is, this is a new technology, a new way of doing things. But when you think about the movie Ray or Bohemian Rhapsody or Walk the Line, where artists were made to look like the actual artist they were portraying, who had all died already, and they're either singing or the music is being managed in a way so it appears that the original songs are being done. I mean, when you think about it, this kind of interpretive approach to artists is done, is done across many mediums. And, this is really a celebration. This is Whitney Houston during the Bodyguard era, when she was at her prime. Yeah. And these great songs are coming out, so that's how we look at it. We think it's terrific.
And that's I think for our audience who's not looking at the same sheet I am, imagine Whitney Houston in that movie. That's the version of it that I'm looking at here anyway.
And she's going to be, remember, you're looking at a picture on a page. She's going to be on stage with six or eight musicians and six dancer backup singers combined, and that's going to be fully produced like something you see at the Chicago Theater.
Will there be costume changes, or will she be in one outfit the whole time?
Costume changes.
Huh. You know, so I looked at the Buddy Holly one and the Roy Orbison one, and maybe this is part of just the mindset that any of us needs to manage if you're uncomfortable with it. If you did an Amy Winehouse tomorrow, I think I would be uncomfortable with it because of the proximity. And maybe Whitney Houston for some people is a little too soon. I never had a chance to see Buddy Holly, so in some ways I don't mind that. I don't mind that at all. I think that's awesome. I wonder if that's the deal. It's like you need some time between the artist passing and the show for some people to become more comfortable with it.
I think that's an incredibly correct and legitimate point of view. I agree. Now, different people have different sensitivities. So for some people it's 2 years, not probably for most people it's not, but maybe it's a shorter period of time, and for some maybe 20 years. We think that this is a very good time for this. Just years have passed. Her legacy is very important. She just came out with a new, or it's how funny I talk.
Look
about,
at you.
And I knew, I know. The song came, she had an album come out recently, or a song come out recently. With a DJ that, you know, that hit all the charts. And that's the other thing about artists, you know, they have these legacies of art that can be interpreted and listened to and combined and applied to different mediums and all that kind of good stuff. So for me, I'm hoping that my kids and my friends and whatever, you know, I give to charity and to the community is my legacy. But artists have this incredible opportunity to touch people's lives for 10 years or 300 years down the road. So I don't know what the right time is to do something, whether this is perfect or not, but I think for most people, this timing is good for Whitney.
We got to go. So you say yes to Chicago. Do you have a date for us?
No, I don't. But we'll announce it as soon as we do.
In the fall of next year?
Yeah, in the fall of next year. Yeah.
Nice to talk to you. Good luck with the tour. And, I'm interested when it comes into Chicago. Thanks for joining us, Brian.
Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Brian Becker is the CEO and chairman of Bass Entertainment, the Whitney Houston hologram tour.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
I think we've...
Here's John Williams.
Already had a couple of those. Been a good show today, don't you think? It's 2:09. We're in the 18th story Skyline Studio downtown. Remember, the Mincing Rascals podcast, judged by the Illinois Broadcaster's best podcast in the state, drops as it always does Thursdays. A new episode for you coming today at 5. Remember, the Mincing Rascals, wherever you get your finer podcasts. It's free. You can just search for it on Spotify or say to your smart speaker, play the Mincing Rascals podcast, or just check it out at WGNradio.com, etc., etc., etc. Jordan Peele's breakout horror hit Get Out was nominated for 4 Academy Awards and earned Peele the Best Original Screenplay honor. The film's score is a remarkable mix of eerie, African, playful, taunting music that you surely notice when Catherine Keener's character hypnotizes Daniel Kaluuya's while loudly stirring her tea.
How do you feel now?
Can I move?
You're paralyzed.
Just like that day when you did nothing. You did nothing.
Now, sink into the floor.
Wait.
Sink.
To underscore that score, the show is going to be shown at the acoustic marvel known as the Auditorium Theater downtown Saturday night. The music will be performed live by the Chicago Symphony Sinfonietta. That music for the movie was written by a guy named Michael Abels, who had never scored a motion picture before, and at the time was the music department, ran the music department at a private school in California. He's sitting in our studio right now. Welcome to the show. Welcome to WGN. How are you?
I'm great. It's great to be here, John. Thanks.
Well done.
Thanks.
When they do the live performance, the music to the movie on the screen, who's going to play the teacup?
The teacup will be played by Catherine herself, who's going to stir it in the film. But all the music behind the teacup is going to be live.
Kind of like they do at Ravinia. So there's a version of a film like this where the music is not on the print of the film or on the digital of the film, and you can
exactly
perform it live.
Yeah, because film scores are very much it's a beautiful, amazing art and craft. And so you really get a chance to appreciate what the score contributes to the film when you see the film, but you hear the music created live.
So you're based in L.A. This is the first movie that you've done. But it's not like you're an unknown, and you have worked here in Chicago before, correct?
Yes, for a long time, actually. I've had a great relationship with the Sinfonietta. They've performed a lot of my concert works, music written just for the pleasure of playing and listening to music, starting sometime in the 90s. So,
how did you and Jordan Peele get together?
He saw one of these concert works I wrote. He saw one of them on YouTube. And he had the producers hunt me down and call me. And I got a call from some producer saying, you're probably not expecting this, but...
And actually, at the time, you didn't know what a hit the movie would be. So
No, the movie hadn't even been shot at that point.
So what's your reaction to that pitch?
Well, at first I thought I was being punked because, you know, someone calls you and says they're a producer. Like, right. So I had to have a friend look, you know, research him to make sure that and the guy had credits. I thought, okay, so I call him back. And then... Jordan, I'd heard of Key and Peele, and he said he's gonna direct a horror film for us, and that's interesting, just that. And then he said, "Would you want to read the script?" I thought, "Of course." Well, so if you look back on it, what happened was I actually got sent what would become the Oscar-winning script for Best Picture, you know, and that script was just genius, and I just thought, this is amazing. And then I met Jordan, and he's just as smart and funny and kind in person as he is in interviews. And I just realized, I just said to him, I just want to be a part of this. I'll do anything you ask. This is amazing. So,
But still, your first movie, have you done TV shows or?
Yeah, I'd studied as a composer, and I had done, even in school, I had done like radio jingles actually, and little TV things. And but I didn't have to get any traction doing it really. And so, I had more success with my concert music. So,
how does one's life change when they score that movie?
Well, gradually. Jordan said that my life would change, and I didn't. You know, I didn't know what to expect, but I'm now able to get. It's given me opportunity to score a lot of other films and work with a lot of other people, both in film and in the concert world, and so. So it's just been a huge blessing and transformative to my life, although it happened over a couple of years.
What was the process like? So you and he meet and you get along, then what happens?
Well, he took the time to meet me before the film had been shot. And a lot of times, mostly, a film has been, a composer's not brought on until the film's already edited together. And the reason for that is because music takes place in time. And so if you can't see how long a scene is, you can theoretically think about scoring it, but you can't really score it until it's edited. But Jordan talked with me before the film had been shot because he wanted some kind of theme song or something. And so we had this great conversation about African-American music and how it's all, he said, it's all got an underlying current of hope. He said, but I want you to drain the hope right out of it. I said, I think what you're talking about is kind of like gospel horror. And he said, yeah. So that was kind of the buzzword I took home. And I did a couple demos for him. And one of them was this piece called Sikiliza Kwawahenga, which is Swahili for Listen to the Ancestors.
Is that a genre that I'm unaware of, gospel horror?
Yes.
That's a thing?
It's not a thing, or it wasn't until Get Out. And Sikiliza is actually the only song in the genre, although who knows what may happen.
Well, this sure works. Okay, let's listen to a little of that. Oh, is this it or this is it? This is it. Swahili we're listening to?
It is.
What are they saying?
They're saying, brother, kimbia, which means run. And the whispers are, Sikiliza Kwawahenga, listen to the ancestors.
Literally, this is what they're singing.
Literally.
Chanting.
And then it ends with, kuakua mwenyewe, which means save yourself. Kimbia.
You wrote that before they shot that scene?
Yeah, or? Yeah. I just wrote that because whenever you work with the director, they have a vision musically for the film, but they need a composer to bring that to life. So we said gospel horror. So I thought, okay, well, that's not a thing, but if it's a thing, here's what I think it sounds like. Yeah.
Well, he must have high-fived somebody when he heard that. I mean, he must have thought, wow, the guy gets it.
Well, I didn't know. You know, he went away and shot the film, and we didn't talk for like 4 months. But then when he edited the film and he brought me back in, that track was the main title. So I thought, okay, well, they must have liked it.
How do you feel about, as I watched the movie, I didn't know that was Swahili, and I didn't know what it was saying. So there's almost two currents of understanding there. There's just sort of the experience of the music as it hits my ears, and then there's the subtext that was a little bit lost on me.
Mm-hmm.
I guess you knew that was going to happen.
Oh,
you're
of course,
okay with that.
Yeah. But, I mean, that's part of the nature of Jordan's films, actually, is that they work on different levels. I mean, Get Out has this great social commentary about it, but you don't have to actually get it for that. If you want to just see it as a thriller, you can. But the reason the words are in Swahili is it's an Easter egg for people to, you know, kind of find if they're looking. But you don't want, you know, the voices represent the departed victims of like lynchings and social injustice.
Okay, that's your that's what you intended for that to be.
Yeah.
And that's maybe current with the film. So maybe it's working on some level I don't even know on me, but that specific subtext is kind of lost on the viewer.
Yeah, but what are you supposed to get? Like, you're not supposed to get that unless you happen to be a Swahili speaker, in which case, awesome. But what you're supposed to get is, listen to these voices. There's something not right here, and it's really bothering me, and I want to know what it is because I can protect myself. But you can tell there's something not good. And you can also tell that they're African-American voices. You can tell these are Black people. And they start out and they say, the only word they say in English is brother. And that's code for Black people talking to Black people. So that's what you get out of it, kind of psychologically. And it's really disturbing, which is the whole purpose of music in a thriller.
I have so much more appreciation for that music now. I wonder if people think about how much thought goes into the music in a movie.
Well, mostly, I hope they don't, because the reason music works so well in film is because music affects you at a subconscious emotional level. I mean, there's no other art, at least to me, that does that so effectively. And so it's perfect because you're watching a film and you're not even aware most of the time that the music is informing how your eyes interpret what you're watching. So mostly I hope people don't think about it, but nevertheless, you can tell how much I think about it and how much people who do that think about it. And so when people come to the auditorium theater, they have a chance to see that music live and hear it live and really experience what it takes to put together that sort of, sound palette.
Michael Abels is in our studio. He scored the 2017 hit Get Out, and are you going to be conducting the Sinfonietta?
I'm conducting the Sinfonietta.
At the Auditorium Theater, Saturday night. You can get tickets at auditoriumtheater.org. Spell theater the fancy way.
with an R-E.
auditoriumtheater.org to get tickets. You know, as you're describing the music, though, and how you want to match the mood and the scene, there's one piece that I grabbed. I'll play after a break. And to me, if I was only listening to this, I would think, is a good thing about to happen or is a funny, ironic thing about to happen? And is that exactly what you wanted me to think and feel when I was watching that scene and listening to this music? Listen to the music after this. Saturday night in Chicago. And if you've not been there, I promise you, even if you're not an audio geek, I'm not, you will be amazed at the acoustics of this place. It's marvelous to look at as well. They're going to show on the big screen Get Out, Jordan Peele's Academy Award nominated film. He did win one for Best Original Screenplay. They're going to show that on the big screen. And then the Chicago Sinfonietta is going to actually perform the score live, sort of like you see at Ravinia, but with better seats. So this is going to be Saturday night. You can get tickets at auditoriumtheater.org. That movie was scored by, and it will be conducted Saturday night, by Michael Abels. He's in our studio telling us a little bit about that process, which must have been fun too, huh?
Yes, it was really fun because first of all, the film is funny. The film is really funny when it's not scaring you. When you score a film, you have to watch it hundreds of times, especially the scenes with music. And I just continued to be impressed and delighted by the performance of the actors and the pacing that Jordan set of the film. It's really masterful.
So there was a scene in the movie that I alluded to a minute ago. We'll play it here, but well, let's just go ahead and play that, Elif.
Scary.
See, if you took the violins out, that would be hopeful, pleasant music.
Wouldn't it?
If you don't have the, what is that, harp?
It's the harp that's playing the melody, yeah.
If you didn't have that, it would be terrifying. So this is an interesting mix of, are you playing with me? Is this going to be scary? Or is this going to be ironic? Are you going to pull the rug out from underneath me? We're going to have a laugh.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you're a really good interpreter of film music. This is a scene where Chris and Rose is taking Chris, her boyfriend, who happens to be black and Rose is white. She takes him upstate to meet her parents at their nice country home.
And are they driving down the road in this?
They have driven down the road, but they've now just arrived at the house. And Chris sees the big house for the first time and sees the groundskeeper, who is also black, who kind of glares at him in a way that makes him like, why? What's going on? And he doesn't. So you don't really know what's going on. You can tell that there's tension, but you can't tell what the nature of it is. So it's foreshadowing for sure.
There are scenes that you have to score that are 20 seconds long.
Yes.
And then there's some that are longer. So you're watching the movie and then writing, I guess, the music and matching what we see in the cut.
Yeah. So the director tells you where he or she is, you know, imagining music. And then the music happens to very specifically to the picture. Like if the music's even more than a couple tenths of a second early or late, you notice from when things are supposed to react. Like there's, especially like in a suspense film, there's some what we call jump scares, which are designed to just make you spill your popcorn. And the music for those has to be right on. It can't be early. And if it's late, it's not. It's just got to be right on. So there's a lot of timing that goes into the music that makes it effective with the picture. It's a very complete marriage of the two.
Does a composer worry about being too literal or too cliche? Pow at the scary scene.
Yes.
But then if you're too subtle, you miss the moment. How do you manage
that? You manage it based on what kind of, really what the moment is. Is this like the sort of terror like, I think of it as an emotional temperature gauge. And I always say, are we at DEFCON 2 or are we at DEFCON 5? You know, and then so emotionally, you know, there's the emotion of something feels not right. That's maybe a 1 or a 2. And then there's help, my head's being ripped off. And that's a 10, you know, so.
And you have all of that in this movie.
Right. Well, you really have to know which level you're hitting, and you have to do the musical techniques necessary to hit that mark.
We're out of time, Michael. I'll watch the movie again. I think a lot of us are now going to with a greater appreciation still. When I watch the movie the next time and I'm listening to the score, what's the moment in the film that you're most proud of where the film intersects with the music?
Oh, my gosh. That's a great question. But I really think that you played the teacup scene and that was the first one I did after I saw it, because I knew it was so iconic. I just knew that scene was going to just be remembered because it's so perfectly written and acted. And I just thought the music has to be every bit as good as everything I'm seeing. So, and I also knew that if Jordan liked the music, that then I would have some themes that I could use, that I could take away and use in the rest of the film. So that scene was as critical as the main title.
That informed the rest of the movie.
Exactly. Like because if the director, you know, likes that cue, then there's a good chunk of ideas and musical sonic palette that you can draw from to create the rest of the score.
You going to work with him again?
I hope so. We did a film called Us that was released earlier this year.
You did the score on that?
Yes.
Shame on me. Nicely done.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks for coming into the studio.
My pleasure, John. This is great.
Yeah. And Saturday night, Auditorium Theater, watch this man and listen to his music as you see Peele's movie on the big screen at the Auditorium Theater, auditoriumtheater.org, spell theater, R-E, auditoriumtheater.org.
Say my name, say my name.
Thank you, Jen.
No one is around you. Say, baby, I love you. You
sing your song.
Say my name, say my name. You acting kind of shady. Ain't calling me baby. Why the sudden change?
Say my name, say my name.
If no one is around you, say, baby, I love you. If you ain't running,
say my name, say my name.
You acting kind of shady.
242 on WGN. What are you doing, Ella?
Madame Tussauds in London has made an addition to its royal lineup to celebrate her musical royalty, according to Music News Facts. And yes, I am talking about Beyoncé. The wax figure is a replica of Beyoncé in her Coachella costume, seen in her homecoming documentary on Netflix. This is a recording of her performing Say My Name with Destiny's Child at the Coachella performance.
By the way, speaking of the performing arts, remember yesterday we were talking about The Devil Wears Prada and the musical that that's going to become?
Sure.
Elton John's going to score it. It opens in Chicago July 14th. I'm just looking at the Broadway and Chicago lineup. Jesus Christ Superstar, Six, My Fair Lady, other shows coming to town. Devil Wears Prada, July 14th to August 16th. Scheduled run for a new show, The Devil Wears Prada, coming to Chicago. 243, this is WGN Radio. We were talking the other day about what Bill Maher said and what James Corden said about it. Have you been following this? So this is Bill Maher from his show last week.
Being fat isn't a birth defect. Nobody comes out of the womb needing to buy two seats on the airplane. We have gone to this weird place where fat is good. It's pointing out that fat is unhealthy. That's what's bad. Fat shaming doesn't need to end. It needs to make a comeback. Some amount of shame is good.
James Corden saw that, and on his show, he said this.
Thanks for that, Bill. So I'm sat at home, and I'm watching this, and all I could think, I was like, oh, man, somebody needs to say something about this. If only there was someone with a platform who knew what it was actually like to be overweight, and then I realized, oh, that'll be me. Here's the thing. I actually have a lot in common with Bill Maher. I do. We both shoot our shows here in the same building. We both host the second most popular talk shows on our network. And we've both made, shall we say, questionable choices in our film careers. Bill was in a movie called Cannibal Women in the Avocado Jungle of Death, which is about, true, about an all-female tribe of cannibalistic avocado farmers. And I appeared in the classic film, The Lesbian Vampire Killers. It's exactly as bad as you think it is. Right? I gotta say, right, that any time I've met Bill Maher in person, he's been nothing but pleasant and kind and nice, which is why I found it so surprising that he or anybody thinks that fat shaming needs to make a comeback, because fat shaming never went anywhere. I mean, ask literally any fat person. We are reminded of it all the time on airplanes, on Instagram, when someone leaves a pie on the windowsill to cool and they give us a look like. Now, there's a common and insulting misconception that fat people are stupid and lazy, and we're not. Right? We get it. We know. We know that being overweight isn't good for us. And I've struggled my entire life trying to manage my weight, and I suck at it, right? I've had good days and bad months. I've basically been off and on diets since as long as I can remember, and, well, this is how it's going, right? We're not all as lucky as Bill Maher, you know? We don't all have a sense of superiority that burns 35,000 calories a day. Bill, I sincerely believe that what you think you're offering here is tough love, and you're just trying to help by not sugarcoating reality for fat people, even though you know how much fat people love sugarcoating things. But the truth is, you're working against your own cause. It's proven that fat shaming only does one thing. It makes people feel ashamed. And shame leads to depression, anxiety, and self-destructive behavior. Self-destructive behavior like overeating. Fat shaming is just bullying. That's what it is. It's bullying. And bullying only makes the problem worse, okay? Now, Billy's right about one thing. He really, really is. This is a health problem. It's an issue that needs to be discussed clearly and honestly. There are numerous reasons why people live their lives at an unhealthy weight. Junk food, portion control, a lack of exercise. These are all major contributing factors. But poverty is also an issue. A study conducted by the University of Michigan Health System found that childhood obesity is directly linked to poverty. But, fun fact, if you shame obese children, Whole Foods will give them free salads. I'm kidding. That's not how Whole Foods works. Sometimes genetics plays a role. You know, there's a molecular geneticist named Jeffrey Friedman who discovered a hormone called leptin. Defects in the leptin gene are linked directly to obesity. A lack of shame is not the issue here. If making fun of fat people made them lose weight, there'd be no fat kids in schools and I'd have a six-pack by now, right? Until we make healthy food and healthcare more accessible and we properly educate people on nutrition and exercise, maybe we can hold back on the whole call fat people virgins until they lose weight strategy. All the time, I am aware today that this is going to be a struggle that I will face for the rest of my life, right? But in the meantime, Bill, please hear me when I say this. While you're encouraging people to think about what goes into their mouths, just think a little harder about what comes out of yours.
James Gordon's response to Bill Maher. I called Nancy Lambert. She's a nutritionist who's been on our show before. She's terrific. And I asked her, what did she hear there? And her answer is after this. So we played Bill Maher saying, fat shaming needs to come back. We need to tell these people they shouldn't be like that. And then James Gordon, who's overweight himself, said, wait a minute, this is bullying. Nancy Lambert's been on with us before. She's a nutritionist at Portrait Health Centers in Grays Lake. And so we called on her again to listen to that and then say, Nancy, what did you think? Hi, Nancy. Welcome back. How are you?
Hi. Hi, John. Thank you so much. I'm very well. Thank you.
For those who don't recall our last visit, Portrait Health Centers in Grays Lake. What is that? What do you do?
I'm a dietitian. I actually talk to, have clients, mostly treat them one-on-one. So whatever situation they might be in, we try and get them to where they want to be.
What did you think of that exchange between Maher and Corden?
Well, I think that James makes perfect sense. There's no purpose in making people feel bad about themselves, and he's right that often it leads to anxiety and people feeling just terrible about themselves and usually leads to overeating. So it doesn't solve anything.
But when the two of them were exchanging their ideas, not to each other, but they each have their own shows, as a person on the sidelines watching that, I wonder, okay, if there's somebody I want to help, what do I say to them? What do I do? Right? Because at least James Gordon said, I think his heart was in the right place, but he's bullying us. He's not helping us. But he didn't say, what could that other person do? What can the parent, what can the spouse, what can the friend do?
Sure, I would go with asking people, suggesting that maybe don't gain any more. Just stay where you are, and actually the best thing to do is to stop dieting. Stop dieting because usually usually people are doing something that is outside of their normal living pattern, outside of something they would can live with for the rest of mm-hmm. their life,
yeah.
And therefore it fails. So the best thing to do is to take a deep look at what people, you know, are doing, your own food behaviors, and making some adjustments that you know you can live with for the rest of your life. We could also increase more plant foods, decrease some of our animal foods. That would be helpful too. Mindfulness is very much included in that, and that means paying attention to the food that we're eating, because we love to eat, we love it, but we hardly pay attention to to the food when we are eating it.
I wonder if, too, either the overweight individual or somebody who's trying to help them, if rather than focusing on the weight or the food, you need to focus on the underlying issues, and let's talk about that, whatever they may be.
Correct. Oh, sure. Most definitely. Definitely. And sometimes it's just a matter of sometimes people do need to talk to a specialist in another area, another field, that sometimes they go together. But it really, it is a matter of really observing what, why people are eating more than they need to. Our bodies are really designed to eat as much as we can and to hold on to that extra weight, because you never know when we might have a famine. So it's really a deep brain center. Our brains really control the whole business. And so if you can get to the point where you just stop gaining and stay where you are, most often people will, it'll all come around and take care of itself in the big scheme of things. Just need to eat a little bit less than we are.
Rather than something dramatic. So there's no hot diet out there that you like right now. You're probably against them in principle, huh?
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much. In general, it doesn't really serve anything. People will see a quick weight loss with some of them. Often it's water is what they're losing, but they're not changing the underlying reason of why they have this much weight in the first place. And if you can't get there, then you it's not something that's maintainable.
That's really a helpful idea. Nancy Lambert is a nutritionist at Portrait Health Centers in Grays Lake. Nancy, how do people get a hold of you up there? I'm down here, if they want to.
Yeah, there is a website, portraithealthcenters.com, and that's one way to get a hold of anybody that works with Portrait. We do have psychologists and we have dietitians at many sites throughout the country, actually.
Hmm. Nice to talk to you again, Nancy. Come down to our studio sometime. We'll make more time, and why don't you visit with us in person?
Oh, I'd love that. Thank you so much.
Nancy Lambert, you betcha. Thank you, Nancy. She's a nutritionist in Grays Lake. Tomorrow, about this time, we'll be wrapping up our Bright Side of Life segment. But now it's every day a bright side. Rokan and Anna DeVlantis. Oh, that's a nice way to put it, isn't it?
That we're a bright side?
Every day. Aww, every day, you guys
you,
are
John.
A four-hour bright side.
I'm not sure that's 100% accurate. But
you know when
I'm
Rose like screaming and yelling about stuff? Is that bright
you
side?
Know, what do you happy. Mean screaming and yelling? All I am doing is I am reflecting the emotions
that's
of
true.
Myself.
And sometimes many others. I do agree with that.
Maybe. We'll see. We'll see. There's a lot going on here. Thank you for asking. But we have got Michael Steele is going to be with us. He's the Man of Steel, of course. Many people know that. First of all, this whistleblower story does have me completely freaked out, because, you know, on one hand, the way that these sorts of stories are now developing, I don't want to get too deep into the weeds here, but now there are people on Capitol Hill who are elected officials whose entire job is to represent dutifully. They swear an oath to dutifully protect the United States, and who are openly misrepresenting things that are going on. And that is a very scary thing. And yeah, right now, even this, the whistleblower is, you know, how can an intelligence guy decide that he doesn't like something the president says? That's not his job. Okay. That is true. Unless he hears the president committing a crime, then that is his job. And so now you're starting to see this story change in that direction. Like, it wasn't just one incident in which he didn't like and so what I would like to know is, I would like somebody to hear what it was that was said, to hear from this whistleblower. We need a referee to hear from the whistleblower. And I don't know who to choose.
We don't know exactly what he said or what he saw or what he heard.
Mm-mm. Right. No, we don't at the moment.
The Inspector General does, doesn't he?
Yes.
And that person, yeah, so that person does, but he's not able to tell.
But the Inspector General is not being allowed to testify. Don't you think that the Inspector General should be allowed to testify? I mean, I don't know. In a closed session, right? This is not, you know, Kavanaugh style. This is like, you know, behind closed doors.
That's what I was just thinking about now. I mean, we do have some history of not asking people questions whose answers might make us uncomfortable. But, yeah, let's find out what the inspector general had to say.
Yeah. I mean, right? I mean, should we? And then maybe it's nothing. It might be nothing. It might be just somebody being an alarmist. It could be. Could be. So I don't know.
Is Michael Steele commenting on this today?
Yes, he'll be commenting on this.
All right. Well,
yes, thank you very much.
I've taken too much of your time once again. I'm going to have a really good show.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.